Morning.
Morning.
There's a little room in here if you guys in the back want to come in here. Can you hear me back there? Well, there are cushions and there's a chair right here. So this morning, I want to talk about some things that I talked about at a retreat that we had just had in southeastern Minnesota. So those of you who are on the retreat, maybe if I get lost, you can remind me of what I said. I'm only being slightly facetious, and I'm actually going to try to take some of the things I talked about and focus them in a little more in relation to practice, relation to Zen practice. So first I'll begin by telling a story. and this is a story about a plane crash in the Andes in 1972 and the survivors of that plane crash. It's documented in The Miracle of the Andes. So this rugby team was flying from Uruguay to Chile, made up of young guys, 17 to 22, who were really, really good rugby players. And they had some of their relatives along, and they crashed. High up in the Andes, with snow all around. And they figured that people would find them right away because this was, they figured it was going to be headlines in newspapers and people would find them right away. But in fact, people didn't find them right away. And they had just a little bit of reserved food. But these were snow-covered Andes, and it was October, which is almost ready for spring. But spring, really, in the end, up that high, doesn't come until December, and it's not much of a spring in terms of food. So they were there. A number of their loved ones had died. The guy who writes the story, his mother and his sister had come with him, and they died in the crash. So here they are. They're up here. They're up there in the crash, just trying to survive and wondering if they can survive. First one leader emerges, and this leader is the guy who's the captain of the rugby team. And what would you expect? He's the captain of the team. He's been the captain of the team for years. He's got really good leadership skills. He always has. He's a student body president. He knows how to rally people. And he thinks of himself as a leader. But the circumstances are not exactly like they are in ordinary life. So he tries a lot of things. They try to stay warm in a particular way under his leadership and his encouragement. They try to take forays away from the crash, which they think will take them out of the mountains. And they fail. And people get sick, and then they at some point, well, not yet in the story, when this fellow is still in leadership, they begin to completely run out of food. So they begin to think, is it actually okay to eat the flesh of the dead bodies around? And I'm not going to go into the details of that. You can read the book if you want. The first fellow, who's the leader, begins to lose his self-confidence. He begins to become very, very unsure of himself and very despairing. And so he kind of fades away and just moves to the back until there isn't really a leader anymore, and they need someone or someone's to motivate them. So then this second guy kind of comes forward, and he doesn't really come forward directly, but people begin turning to him. And he's the he's a much more spiritual guy, a more religious guy. And these are good Catholic young men, been raised in Catholicism. And he begins leading them in prayer vigils and talking to them about God's will. And they begin moving toward him, thinking that he's close to God, that's going to help them. The more they pray, the more they turn themselves over to God's will, the more people suffer and more people die. So then the fellow who is the kind of the priest-to-be in the group begins to think, oh, my God, why hast thou forsaken me, right? Oh, what can I do? This God is letting me down. Is this God really there for us? Or is it going to... I thought he would at least save those of us who were virtuous, whatever that is, but you know. So he then begins to lose his confidence, his faith in his belief system, his everything, and he dies. So then the guy who writes the book, whose nickname is Nando, then they are leaderless. They were 22 survivors, and now they're down to 11, I think. So 11 people have died. And so Nando, who doesn't particularly think of himself as a leader, was never trained as a leader, doesn't really have any specific conception of God. It's not that he doesn't think there's a God, but the God that these people conceived of, or that can be conceived of, he doesn't. He never really bought into anyway. So he says, well, we're next to a huge mountain. I can take one step. I can take one step, and I want you to go with me. And those of you who heard me at the retreat know who he chose. He chose the guy who was in medical school, the guy who was in training to be a physician, to take care of the food. And I won't get into that, because we don't need to do that on Sunday morning, or maybe any morning. So, and then a third guy went along. But Nando, he had some love for his dad, who we knew was out there. He had love for the guys in the camp, but he didn't know. He knew he could take a step. He knew he could take another step. He knew he could take another step. But often he didn't know if he'd be able to take more than one step. And the conditions were awful. They had frostbite. They had enough food, and they knew how to melt water. So they just kept going, and they went up to 19,000 feet. He said he wouldn't have tried it if he'd realized it was 19,000 feet, because at about 14,000 feet, they couldn't even breathe. He had to slow down. In Zen, we say one step, one breath. But what if you can just take with one step a quarter of a breath? Well, he did it. One step, a quarter of a breath. He slowed his steps down. He went that slow, but he was able to breathe just enough. So they got up to 19,000 feet, came back down. The two of them, the third guy had dropped down, but he and the physician-to-be, and they met a peasant down at the other side who just kind of seemed to be straggling out there. And they told the peasant their story, and then... he rushed them into some little village, and they got a helicopter, and they saved everyone who was left. So that's the story. So what does that story say? It says lots of things. This guy then becomes a hero. He becomes a hero, and he's all over the papers all over the world, and they want him to do inspirational speaking, but he's never spoken in his life. I'm not going to tell that story. There's another story about him being an inspirational speaker. But what does it say? Well, one thing it says is having an image of who we are doesn't necessarily help us. I talked a few months ago about the work of a psychologist named Carol Dweck. Her work is at Stanford University. And she talks a lot about people who have fixed mindsets and people who have flexible mindsets. And the first guy had a fixed mindset. He had been trained to be a leader. He thought of himself as a leader. There were certain moves a leader made, and he was actually confined by his idea of being a leader. He was not able to go beyond that, so that when he failed, he just fell apart. And the man of God, he was trained, going back to catechism, he was the guy. Everybody thought, there's some softness about him, some openness. He really seems to be able to communicate with God. People wanted to hang around him. So he developed an image of himself. Because, you know, we do that. We do that, right? We take in what of a man of God. So when God wasn't working, when he wasn't able to communicate with God, he not only fell apart, he died. He died. But we're so fixated on what people tell us about who we are, that if we lose it, what do we have left? But then there was Nando, the third guy. Nando, well, he was just in the backfield on the rugby team. He was a tall guy. People liked to hide behind him. He was not a leader. He had no special conception of God. He wanted to go. He went to church every Sunday. He wasn't an atheist or agnostic, but he had no special conception or idea of God that was going to save him or save certain people and help others and not help. He didn't know, but he knew he could take a step. He knew he could take a step. So Carol Dweck says that there are, and this is just, you don't have to believe this exactly, that there are people with fixed mindsets and people with flexible mindsets. And the fixed mindset doesn't always work. And when I was giving a talk a few months ago, she talks about Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan actually was a flexible mindset guy, not a fixed mindset. Michael Jordan wanted to be in the first string in high school basketball. He really worked hard. He practiced every day to make the first string. He wanted to go to college and do basketball. He didn't get into his first college of choice. He didn't get the scholarship he wanted. He went out and he practiced. He practiced. He practiced. He practiced. He practiced. He got into that college. You know, he did well in college, right? He thought he was good. There was one NBA team he wanted to play for. He didn't get it. He practiced. He practiced. His whole life was like that, except at one point when he left the Chicago Bulls. You guys remember this. At one point, he seemed to get a fixed image. I'm the man. I'm the man. So he moved from, what was it? It was basketball to baseball, I think. And he didn't practice for that whole time. And then he came back and he thought, oh. He had to let go of that fixed mindset, because when he came back, his moves were off. His moves were off. And so there's research to explain the importance of Zen practice from my point of view. Of course, Carol Dweck doesn't talk about Zen practice, nor does Nando talk about Zen practice. He didn't even know what Zen is. Nevertheless, insoluble problems come up in our lives, and we want to translate them into something. And we can't always. We can't always. And when we can't is when we get discouraged and we quit. So I also talk in the retreat about case 91 from the Blue Cliff Records. Very simple. Very simple. Young Juan was with his attendant, and he said to his attendant, "Bring me the rhinoceros fan." And the rhinoceros fan is made out of rhinoceros horn, and it's got a picture of an ox looking at the moon. The ox looking at the moon. The ox or a rhinoceros looking at the moon. Some translations say the ox. Some translations say a rhinoceros. Well, for the Chinese, the rhinoceros belongs to the ox family. Don't ask me about this, but and the rhinoceros and the ox are a symbol of the Zen mind, the open, flexible, still mind. So he says to the attendant, "Bring me the rhinoceros fan." And what does the attendant say? You guys know. Most of you know, even who weren't at the retreat. The attendant says, what?
It's broken.
And the teacher says, well, bring me the rhinoceros then. And the attendant freezes. He freezes. And there's a second student there. And the second student immediately draws a circle in the air, draws the character for rhinoceros, and bows and leaves the room. And the teacher smiles. So the first student, the attendant, he's really trying to do a good job. He has an image of himself as being the student who's closest to the teacher. He freezes because it's inconceivable how he could bring a rhinoceros into the room. It's inconceivable. The second student moves right into the inconceivable, right into it, completely. He doesn't know. He just moves into it and does something. You think he's planned it out ahead of time? No. He's there. He's available. He's not caught by image. So remember the Enron guys? The Enron guys, talk about. Did any of you ever read that book? It's big and thick about Enron. Those were the A and A plus performers. They'd been A and A plus for a lot of years, all of them. They were the A team. Everybody knew they were the A team. They started off not being unethical. They were ethical at first. We're the A team. And they had tremendously successful careers in other companies. And they came together at Enron as the A-team. They knew they were the A-team. They conceived of themselves as the A-team. Everybody else in the whole corporation and even the President of the United States thought of them as the A-team, right? But we won't get into politics, right? What?
Yeah. Let's not say much about
that. But they... And what did they do? Well, they were so caught by their image of who they should be, what they were, that they committed all kinds of things that are unethical. And maybe some of them started out unethical, but not when you read the book. Not when you read the book. They just got caught. They got caught in this idea of who they were, who they should be. So they weren't able to go beyond that. So, in Zen practice, we have a possibility. Since we're not all born with flexible mindsets, not very many of us are born with flexible mindsets. And when we come to Zen practice, I will say that, speaking for myself, it's people with kind of fixed mindsets who more gravitate to Zen practice. Because we see that we're caught by something. We see the possibility that we could go beyond the conceivable and loosen up a little bit. Loosen up a little bit. and really, actually, we can find our home in the inconceivable, which is not out there, but which is right here. That's the only home that has any real stability to it, because the conceivable, sooner or later, is going to mess with you, or you're going to get messed up by it. So So that's what Zen practice is all about. It's about going beyond the known, the image, to just what we can't conceive, and just being in it and finding our strength in it, finding our sustenance in it. So I want to talk about five ways in which we do this in Zen practice. And I've talked about all of them before, but not together like this. One is that when, much as possible, when we come up against, as Zen practitioners, when we come up against a difficulty, whatever it is, a challenge, a struggle, someone criticizes us, we have a setback, we stay with it. We don't run away. We just stay with it. Just with, as I've been talking about in my talks, bare attention. Just stay with it. It's possible that that guy who was the attendant, when he noticed that he froze, couldn't bring the rhinoceros into the room, that if he was really a sincere Zen student, he would just stay with that feeling of frozenness. He would not run out and say, I'm giving up Zen forever. This Zen is too hard. He would just stay with it until it began to melt in non-judgmental, bare attention. So the head teacher here before me, Karen Suna, whom a few of you knew, I once in a conversation with her, I asked her what have been the pivotal points in her Zen practice. And she said, well, she didn't know anything about pivotal, but she talked to me about a time when she had been working on her PhD dissertation in psychology, and how she felt really criticized by the members of her committee, how she was really struggling with this whole dissertation thing and didn't know how this related to helping people. Couldn't figure. And then the egos of the people on her committee, and she just felt like she was always struggling. And she went to talk with Katagiri Roshi about it. And of course, if you knew Katagiri Roshi, you already know what he would have said. Although sometimes he didn't, you know. But usually he would say, as he did with Karen, "Oh, this is an opportunity for you. Very good," which he said to her. Only he didn't say it casually. He didn't say it facetiously. He just tried to support her, to stick with it, to stay with it, to see what happened, even though she didn't know anything, even though she felt discouraged. And he said, at this point in your practice, when you're discouraged, if you just bring yourself back to what is, to your cushion and to your life, without judging, you have a chance to bloom. And she was very moved, so she finished her dissertation and became a psychologist and all that stuff. But she said to me that that had been one of the pivotal moments in her Zen practice, when he said that to her, and when she just decided to stay with it. So that's the first thing that, and if you read all the Zen literature, coming up against a difficulty and just being with it rather than running away often leads to a big opening, a big melting of the iceberg. I mean, the difficulty is about ego, isn't it? It's about ego. I mean, maybe all those people are bad out there. They're critics and they're judgmental. But Zen is all about seeing ego and letting ego melt a little bit so it can open up. And the second one is Zazen. Zazen. Actually, for me, Zazen is all of them, but Zazen, sitting meditation. So if we sit in meditation and we do concentrated meditation, we try to concentrate whether we're watching our breathing or counting our breathing or repeating something to ourselves or doing something else. At some point, we experience a little bit of space between our thoughts. And that little bit of space, we may like it or we may not like it, but it's inconceivable. If it's really space, it's inconceivable. We're letting, when we experience that space, we're letting go a little bit of our, of this solid self that we've created. We created this solid self. Our culture created this solid self. So those, that space is encouraging. Of course, then we lose it and we get pissed and we say, you know, how much can I have next time? And my practice isn't good. But that's just all our stuff. The fact is that if you sit, you experience a little bit of space. And that little bit of space is entryway into big space. The little bit of space between the boxcars and the freight train that's going around 99 miles an hour, if you really see that little bit of space, you can see beyond it to the sky, to the fields, to the earth, to everything. And then the second way in which we talk about Zen meditation is shikantaza, which is not trying to concentrate. Not trying to concentrate. Based on, if you really read Dogen, he said, he never said anything about concentrating. He said, just think, just sit facing a wall, straighten your back, get in the full lotus, he said. Well, how about that? But we have American bodies, you know. And think non-thinking. So this has nothing to do with meditation. Just think non-thinking. So just getting yourself in this position, just having a wall and nothing else, no book, nobody to massage your back when you, no television set, nothing. That's beginning to enter into the inconceivable. It's, you can't conceive of it, can you? That's why you hate it. Because you want to live in the conceivable. We all do. Up to a point. To a point. But, it, as Dogen says, after a while, there's a falling away. There's a falling away of dependence on the conceivable. And a real opening. And a real joy that comes out of that. So that's the second way. And the third way I've been talking about also in my talks lately, bringing the aggregates into view. So we say in Buddhism, right, the self is a fiction, ego is a fiction. Instead of ego, we have sense experience. We have sensation that comes from our sense experience. We have perception. We have emotion or mental tendency, and then we have thinking about it, number five. So the five aggregates, thinking about it all. So if you think about what Nando did when he was in that 12,000 feet or 14,000 feet or 16,000 feet, he didn't know anything about Zen, but he had to bring the aggregates into view, meaning that he couldn't be stuck on his thinking and his emotion. He had to come back to the immediacy of just taking a step, to the immediacy of the feeling in his body as he took a step. So he was forced by extremity to not be hypnotized by the fourth and fifth aggregate as we usually are. We're usually hypnotized by our emotion and our thinking, our interpretation about our experience. But those circumstances forced him. Well, in Zen, we practice this. We practice bringing the aggregates into view and specifically coming back to the immediate sense experience and the feeling, not the emotion, but the felt sense, so that we don't get stuck on so much on the last two. And if we do that, then we're opening into the inconceivable, because our self that's trying to manage this whole thing, trying to control it, begins to just be in abeyance for a little while. Just for a little while, in abeyance. And we see the whole thing. And then when we see the whole thing, there isn't any we that's seeing it. There's just seeing. That's why I say bare attention. I don't talk about regular attention. I mean bare. Then the fourth thing that we can do in Zen is we can read Zen teaching and we can hear Zen teaching. Over and over and over again. Oh, because Zen teaching is all about letting go of our fixed mindset. It's all about that. And if we're going to do that, we have to introduce thoughts that are about flexibility, that are about openness, that are about being light about our mindset, not getting all caught up in whatever our trip may be at the moment. So we read, we reflect, we have study groups, but when we do study groups, we're not trying to learn anything. Well, learning things are fine. You end up learning stuff, that's cool. But we're really trying to use this to change our psyche little by little by little. And it happens. It happens. So my teacher, I can remember my first teacher saying over and over and again until I got tired of hearing it. And, you know, when I would talk about the difference between my practice and someone else's practice or my life and someone else's practice, he would say, oh, it's all the same. And after a while, I just wanted to punch him. I mean, I never would have done that, but I just felt like I wanted to punch him. It's all the same. But, you know, the 130th time he said that was right in the middle of a retreat, and I had been working so hard that I sort of quit working and was just there, and I just went into the inconceivable. And he didn't say it any differently. It wasn't any different, but it was just he said it 159 times already. And finally, there was bare attention to hear that. When you hear that, then the hearer is the heard. And this isn't something mystical. Actually, what happens? The hearer is the heard. So in the fifth thing that we can do as Zen practitioners is that we can change our labeling. We can change it. You shouldn't get too involved in this because it gets to be a big ego trip, but just a little bit, just gently and sort of lightly. You can change your thinking. If you're saying, I am smart, or I am dumb, or I am a good dancer, how about I am a lousy dancer? I'm a lousy dancer. Then just modify that a little bit. I mean, say that. Let's pretend that last night I went out with my wife. I did go out with my wife, but let's say we went dancing after we had dinner, which we have not done since my daughter's wedding, probably, which was probably 8 years ago or something. So let's say we went out dancing. Okay. Let's say that I stepped on my wife's foot. Let's say I stepped on both of her feet. Well, then I could say to myself, I'm a lousy dancer. I always knew I was a lousy dancer. Why'd you get me to do this, Linda? Et cetera, et cetera. Right? Fifth aggregate out on this, right? And then bring lots of fourth aggregate emotion into it, like anger at her for not letting me be who I am. Now notice the word not letting. Notice that, how we do that. Not letting. I could do it the aggregate way, which would mean I just notice the I just have the physical sensation of stepping on her foot. I just have the felt sense of I just have the perception, oh, I stepped on her foot. And I just have the emotion, oh, this is awful. And then I just have some thought about, oh, I'm really sorry I did this. And I don't need to turn it into, I am an awful dancer. And then those I am a something or other labels capture us. This, in the case of Nando and his two friends, his first friend was captured by, everybody had told him, his first friend from the time he was 6 years old, that he was a leader. That's all he knew how to be. And so when he failed at that, he had no life yet. The spiritual guy, everybody knew. So when he failed at that, he had no life left. Nando had grown up in some other circumstances. We don't know about it. I don't know about them. But he was able to just be there. Natural Zen. Not very many of us have natural Zen. Even, of course, does he have natural Zen in his daily life? Maybe not. Maybe just situations of extremity. Some situations of extremity often bring out natural Zen. Do you know what I mean? You just bring it out. So I have a grandson who is 2 years old. He'll be 2 years old on November. Should remember this, November 20 or something like that. And my daughter is always asking me about Zen. She used to come here when she was little, and she kind of grew up coming here. And a couple of years ago, I gave her some John Kabat-Zinn stuff, you know, and she was going to practice that. I don't know if she's not or is or now is or not now. I don't think she is because she's got a baby. She was talking to me last summer, and she said, "Well, what's the Zen way of raising Ethan?" I said, "Oh, Aaron, there's no Zen way. Just do it." And she said, "Come on, Dad. Come on, Dad. You teach Zen, don't you?" I said, I should have said to her, but I only teach about the inconceivable. That would have been kind of rude, my own daughter. Kind of rude to you guys, too, I think. So I said, "Well, you can read this book by Carol Zweck from Stanford University. She doesn't say anything about Zen, but I think it will give you some ideas." And so I sent her this page from the book. And this page is specifically on raising children. Raising children, if you want your child to develop, of course you don't, but if you want your child to develop a fixed mental set, or if you want your child to develop a flexible mental set. Well, I would say we're all kids, so let's try this stuff. Let's try this stuff in our lives. Really, I'm serious. So the fixed mental set. You learn that so quickly. You're so smart. Fixed mental set. Flexible mental set. That homework is so long and involved. I really admire the way you concentrated and finished it. See, not boxing him in to some, you are this. You're not this. Whatever you think you are, you're not. You're just completely not. B. Look at that drawing. Is he the next Picasso or what? Fixed mental set, right? Fixed mental set. Flexible mental set. That picture has so many beautiful colors. Tell me about them. Next one. Last one for fixed mental set. You're so brilliant. You got an A without even studying. People started telling that to me when I was very young, and it messed up my whole teens because I was frozen as a teenager. I felt I was supposed to be someone, and I couldn't be the person that they told me I was when I was young. I didn't know how to do it. So I didn't go into the inconceivable. I just froze for all my teen years. Instead of, you're so brilliant, you got an A without even studying, you put so much thought into this essay. It really makes me understand Shakespeare in a new way. Right? Right? And then D, you are a prodigy at the piano. Wow. When I listen to you, I think you are really gifted. Two, the passion you put into that piano piece gives me a feeling of joy. How do you feel when you play it? So I sent this to my daughter. She said, "Well, Dad, I'm working on this, but it's hard." It is hard. It's hard for all of us. It's hard. So I think that's what I want to say for today. Except that Zen practice is all about bringing the rhinoceros into our lives. As John Tarrant says, the Zen teacher John Tarrant, that's what it's about. Bring the rhinoceros into your lives. Even if you're scared, bring her in. She's always here, waiting to come in. Get to know her. Get to know her. Well, Okay, any questions, comments? Yeah.
I have a rhinoceros story.
Oh, you do? Okay.
I traveled a long way, and I saw the rare black rhinoceros.
To wear what rhinoceros?
Black.
Black, uh-huh.
Very endangered. But it was getting dark, and the game park was closing, and we were after curfew. So we had a brief moment to see the black rhino. And then our guide said, "We have to drive away." And we sat down and sped away. And when we got to the top of the hill at the edge of the park, the guard there chastised us for coming late and then said, "I've never seen a rhinoceros chasing a Land Cruiser." Nor had we. Because why would a rhinoceros chase us?
Thank you. Thank you. Questions, comments?
So, throughout your talk, you were talking about this guy doesn't know about Zen or this or that, and it brings to mind the idea of labeling. This is Zen and that is Zen. And to me, in some ways, Zen is just about living your life. And I think about Katagiri Roshi saying, you know, at beyond Zen, what concerns me most is just what it means to be a human being in this world.
That's right.
And so if we get rid of the label Zen, then it's just about life.
I completely agree. However, as you know, it's...
There is
a practice to do. Since we're not too many of us are naturally Nando. And you don't have to call it Zen practice, but you can call it
life
nothing,
practice or something.
Huh?
Life practice.
Yeah, life practice, and
it's just another label too.
Good. Thank you. Anybody else? What else?
Yeah. I can't remember the third or fourth one you're saying. Thinking about not thinking.
Uh huh.
For me, that.
Talk a little bit more about it. Can you guys hear him?
Yeah. It's a subtler way. Like you say, it's hard to talk about these words, but even thinking about not thinking is not the way I really want to put it. It's just letting your whole gist all of experience kind of fuse into one. And I guess the word let is what comes to mind. Is let. The reality or consciousness. Do whatever it does. And And, you know, when you get deeper and deeper into that process, it really becomes clear how, you know, your reality is a product of, you know, what your beliefs are.
Yep. Thanks. Other people.
I'm having trouble thinking of Michael Jordan as a flexible mindset. Just because the way you described it, it seems like he has this fixed idea of what he is that he retains regardless of what anybody else says.
Well, that's interesting. Now, she used him as an example. I don't know too much about his life other than what she pulled out. Her point was that he had joy in doing this, that he kept doing this, and that failure or success, he just did it. He just did it and did it and did it. And the only time he felt that he had accomplished something and he believed what people said about him was when he actually froze, and then when he came back, he wasn't able to do it. So I don't know enough about him, his life, other than reading the chapters in her book.
That makes sense if he's focusing on the joy of doing it.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's what she said.
From what I've read about Michael Jordan, he had a very strong support of his mom and dad. He was really close to them.
Uh-huh.
And they just, from, I read something in a book about him once, that they supported him in whatever he wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, that's important. That's why in Zen we have Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Two out of the three of those are support. Sangha is the community, and Buddha is the teacher. So, gee, and I would imagine that if I knew about Nando, if I knew about, I mean, he talked about growing up in a family where his parents really liked him, whatever he did, and were there for him, whatever he did. So, and a lot of us didn't have that, though. Most of us didn't have that. So we use Sangha and Buddha to return to just seeing and viewing and experiencing the inconceivable as the ordinary. As the ordinary. But it's a long process. But if you think of it as a long process, then don't think of it as long. It's just a process. And you say, it's a long process. No, forget that. Just do it. Anything else?
Kim, I used to think that I was someone that couldn't sew.
Ah. Oh, okay. All right.
I sewed a rocket.
Uh-huh.
So now, rather than take that too seriously, I say that I believe in religious miracles.
Do you want to tell them what you sewed? Show them what you sewed.
This is like a version of sewing the monk's robe, and so it's a practice of entering into Buddhist practice. Uh-huh.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.